if the police at the time of his arrest exceeded their own protocols.
Mr. Boyden,
go ahead.
Let's jump ahead to the question that the jury posed after they had been instructed. Do you recall what it was?
Your Honor, I don't recall it specifically. It was written in the terms of laymen and laywomen, not lawyers. So we have to sort of, I think, interpret it as best we can. Our argument is that it's a cry out from the jury room to give them the kind of instruction that they rarely get, because usually the answer is, well, look at the instructions.
May I supply the question that they sent? If we find that the defendant acted in self-defense, does that mean all the charges no longer matter due to self-defense?
That sounds correct, Your Honor.
Can you tell me how that translates to apply to your argument that there should have been a definition of unreasonable force? Because it seems to me that question is, does self-defense apply to all three counts?
And I think it does, Your Honor. I think it is their request to have what the Yoder case talked about, when a trial court must instruct on the issue of self-defense, and that reading into it, analyzing it, I think the judge should have then given them the language that I also quoted from the Yoder opinion, in that an ordinary, prudent, and intelligent person with the knowledge of the La Vista police officers, all three of them, would have deemed necessary under the circumstance when they approach what they think is a teenage boy sitting on his bicycle talking to one of them, and they come up behind him, pull him off the bicycle, and all three of them fall down into a dog pile.
Isn't there evidence that the defendant placed one of the police officers in a chokehold?
That was after the excessive force was used on him, and that's what he was acting in self-defense, in terms of what the Yoder case talks about and what we argue a jury should have been able to factor into it in terms of what's self-defense and what's reasonable force. It was unreasonable force for them to do what they did.
Counsel, it's my understanding that you offered four different instructions on reasonable force, and the judge decided not to use any of them. Is that correct?
Four instructions were offered and not used. That's correct.
But you did not object to the self-defense instruction that was used as instruction number six. Is that also correct?
Didn't have to, Judge. That's correct. But we didn't have to, because the Yoder case says in 1997 that the trial judge has a duty to instruct on self-defense. And in our argument, not only does he have the duty to instruct as he did in Exhibit 6, the jury instruction, but he needed to add in the other language.
Where do you find in State v. Yoder that it specifically says that the definition of unreasonable force must be included in the jury instruction?
Your Honor, it's the language that I mentioned earlier. We have also stated that a police officer in making an arrest must use only reasonable force, which is that amount of force which an ordinary, prudent, and intelligent person with the knowledge and in the situation of the arresting police officer would have deemed necessary under the circumstances. And that's cites to State v. Thompson and Wagner versus City of Omaha.
But does that case say that a trial court must include that definition in the self-defense instruction? You don't disagree. There was a self-defense instruction given.
That's
right?
Correct. That's
and
correct.
In that self-defense instruction, the jury would have had to find, in order to determine that the defendant acted in self-defense, that the officer used unreasonable force, right?
Right.
And your argument is the jury should have been given a definition of unreasonable force, and because there's that language in State v. Yoder?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, because the jury, they're not lawyers. They're men and
women.
They
don't know what unreasonable is?
No, just like a jury doesn't know what reasonable doubt is. What could be simpler? Reasonable doubt. Everybody should know that. No, that was another instruction in this case. That's an instruction that's gone all the way to the United States Supreme Court, because lay people don't understand what reasonable doubt is. It has to be explained to them, and it's not any stretch of the imagination to say that they don't understand what reasonable force is, in the context of a criminal prosecution where the state of Nebraska brings a felony and two misdemeanor charges against a teenage boy who, when he is doing nothing, not committing any crime, he's out in the daylight in a parking lot, and some citizen thinks that he's about to break into a car or cars, and three officers converge on him and violate the terms of their own use of force instructions that they're supposed to be bound by, that if they don't follow them, they're brought in on internal affairs investigation.
Mr.
Absolutely
Boylan,
not.
If the jury didn't understand what reasonable force is, wouldn't the question that have come out from the jury room be, what does unreasonable force mean? Because the question that came out when I read it seems to be, does the self-defense apply to all three charges? Which is completely different than, we don't know what unreasonable force means.
Well, we can't speculate, but we have to give the defendant the benefit of the doubt, the presumption of innocence. And when we look at all the litigation that's gone on up to the United States Supreme Court on what two simple words, reasonable doubt, mean, then I think it's not a great extrapolation to see that these lay people were struggling with this. And all they got back was a slap in the face by saying, look at the instructions. Well, there's not enough in the instructions. That's why their question is the way it is. That's because they're lay people and they're looking for help, and we can give it to them if this court follows up on the precedent set in 1997 by State versus Yoder and says, trial court, you gotta define what reasonable force is, just like we told you to define what reasonable doubt is.
Counsel, do you have any cases, any authority where this definition from State versus Yoder was used since 1997, either it was used as an instruction or it was not used and appealed and the court found that the conviction should be set aside?
Just like in 1997, here in 2016, Judge, case of first impression. The court handled it as a case in first impression when it first came up in 1997. Here we're back in 2016. Now is this court's opportunity to point the lower courts in the right direction so that jurors in the future won't have to struggle with what somebody else says is common knowledge. They should know what that means. They don't.
I think you're out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Good afternoon.
May it please the court, my name is George Love on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Move that out of my way. Let's start out with the idea that the use of force statute is a distinct statute from that of self-defense. The use of force statute is if Sam hits Joe, Joe ducks, and then hits Sam, was Sam entitled to use that amount of force in defending himself? The use of force statute gives the various definitions of when that's possible. The most important thing it does is it excludes police officers. You can't use force even in an unlawful arrest, ergo it doesn't apply. There's no evidence in this case that the defendant did not know that he was dealing with police officers. The next step is he entitled to a self-defense instruction? Excuse me. Now, I think there's a very good argument to be made, although probably just for academic sake, that the defendant was not entitled to a self-defense instruction. Because if you look at the Yoder case, that is very similar, very analogous to what went on in this case. Verbal confrontation, taken to the ground, grabs the handcuffs, or in our case, being grabbed, taken to the ground, he puts one of the officers in a chokehold, the other gets a hold of him and breaks the chokehold, and they take him to the ground. He resists, in this case, by refusing to put his hands behind his back and allow himself to be handcuffed. That's very analogous with what happened in Yoder. And the Supreme Court said, you're not entitled to a self-defense instruction in that case because here's the words, there's no evidence for a legally cognizable claim of self-defense. And to be legally cognizable, there has to be both a reasonable and good faith belief in the necessity of using the force, and the force used in defense must be immediately necessary and must be justified under the circumstances.
So apparently there was evidence of that in this case, otherwise the judge would not have had to give the instruction.
And I think that's a right, Your Honor, and here's what I believe occurred. I think reasonable force is a question of fact for the jury under the circumstances. I don't think you can define reasonable force the same way that an analogous situation that the courts always look to the totality of circumstances in Fourth Amendment issues, because reasonable force is something that's dynamic. It's not going to be defined for every possible conceivable set of circumstances. So I think it's a question of fact for the jury, and that's why he got the self-defense instruction, because the defense put on evidence through witnesses that said he never saw him never saw the defendant resist, never saw him doing anything untoward towards the police officer. That at least, I suppose, if you want to consider that as evidence in the sense that did it raise a legally cognizable claim of self-defense, I think you can make a real argument that it did not. But nonetheless, the court, I think, in an abundance of caution, going with the idea that evidence was presented on self-defense, gave the self-defense instruction and left that question left that question of fact for the jury to decide. And obviously they decided adversely to the defendant in this case. Now, use of force in terms of whether it was reasonable or unreasonable, I've already said it was a question of fact. That makes the use Exhibit 17, the use of force manual, irrelevant. And basically the court's right, because you're going to confuse the jury if you bring in use of force, except if it's a police officer and, oh, by the way, you get self-defense. They
but
don't
the court,
apply.
The court didn't find that Exhibit 17 was irrelevant, did it? Didn't it find that it was Rule 403 outweighed the prejudice?
Well, in some sense, yes, but he also, Exhibit 17 was only accepted as an offer of proof, okay? And I would also point out,
it was offered into evidence.
Well, yes, but not a substantive evidence. It's only for an offer of proof.
Right, but the reason the judge rejected it was because he found it confused the jury, which is different than finding that it's irrelevant.
True, but my argument goes back to the idea that the use of force statute does not apply simply by its very own words. The police officer involved, even an unlawful arrest can't be resisted. So it doesn't apply.
Is there ever a point where an officer can use unreasonable force to apprehend a person that does not create a self-defense situation?
The answer is you don't have any rights until you get a courtroom, okay? That really is the truth. You don't have rights until you get to a courtroom. So if a police officer makes an error in judgment and uses unreasonable force, that's what you put on as evidence in order to get your self-defense instruction. And the reasonableness of that force used by the police officer is a question of fact for the jury.
But does the jury then need a definition of what constitutes unreasonable force?
No.
In order to make that determination?
No, Your Honor, and the reason for that is because that's within, again, every factual scenario is going to be different. There's going to be various circumstances. So was it reasonable? That's a question posed, or a question that the jury has to answer under each bit of evidence presented in the particular case. In other words, it's not beyond the common sense of the average person to say that that's not right, that's not reasonable. That is not beyond the ken of the average juror.
That amount of force which a police officer in the position of these officers would have used?
The Supreme Court in the Utter case, I guess that's the pronunciation, the Utter case did define what reasonable force was in the sense of, or unreasonable force, and that he has to use it the amount of force necessary under the circumstances to effectuate an arrest. Now, that may be deadly force in one case, and it simply may be a nerve pinch in another case.
Right, but in determining what is reasonable force, are you looking at what a police officer, a reasonable police officer in this situation would have done?
I think the answer is that given it has to be a legally cognizable claim, it has to be probably looked at from the point of view of the defendant, okay? In other words, in the sense that he has to present enough evidence to get by that reasonable good faith belief in the necessity of using force, that it's immediately necessary, and that it's justified under the circumstances. That has to be the evidence presented in order to warrant the self-defense.
And that's what I'm getting at. Is that judged from whose perspective? What a reasonable police officer would have done in the situation?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, but I think it's both. I think it's the circumstances that determine what is reasonable, the totality of circumstances. What was the evidence from the defense? What was the evidence from the prosecution on the amount of force used or the events that occurred and the force involved, whether or not you have established a legal cognizable claim? I don't think it's an objective standard from the view of either one. I think it's a totality of circumstances, really, in order to have a legally cognizable claim. And I would also point out, in some sense, for academic, where this discussion is academic, because it was never preserved for appellate review. He did not ask the trial court to define unreasonable force was. So he's waived it for appellate review.
Except that he's asking us really to review it under plain error, under the principle of...
Plain error is a court prerogative, not a party prerogative.
Right, but under the principle of law that a court has an independent duty to properly instruct on the law.
If the duty arises, in this case it never arose, because there's a good argument, like I said, with Yutter, for example, this case is very analogous. No legally cognizable claim for self-defense was raised.
But the judge found there was, because
and
the
that's
judge,
what, absolutely.
And because if you go that way, and after listening to your explanation of how this is all comes about, as a lawyer, I'm wondering how confused a layperson would be in this regard, which leads me to wonder if maybe there would be a need for this definition.
The answer, I think, to that, Your Honor, is simply this. The confusion is avoided by leaving the use of force out, just as the trial court did, and giving the self-defense instruction.
Well, it talks about using unreasonable force, though. I mean, that's part of the instruction.
Pardon me?
It's the unreasonable force. It's part of the instruction. The officer used unreasonable force against the defendant.
Was it unreasonable? That's a question of fact for the jury.
But if the jury doesn't know what that means, how are they going to do
it? You're assuming that, Your Honor, and I'm saying that under basically case law that a regular, ordinary person, that's why we see them as jurors, can understand what unreasonable is in the context of the particular case.
I thought Mr. Boylan made an interesting argument that we do define reasonable doubt because we aren't going to make the assumption that the jurors understand what that is.
But there's no reversible error here simply because it was never preserved for appellate review in the first place.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Matter is deemed submitted and counsel are excused. Thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you.
The next matter before the court is In Re Guardianship.